True Life Under God, called what I want to share with you this morning, Genesis 47, beginning at verse 28 through to the end of chapter 48. We're coming to the end of Jacob's life. Jacob is very soon to die, and very soon to be taken to be buried. Come up with 4 points that I want to share with you this morning. Living your last days, living under God, living out God's will, and living with God. Firstly, the last few verses of chapter 47. Living your last days. Maybe you're aware that in the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, something between a third and a half of the whole of those Gospels are given over to just 7 days in Jesus' life. The last week of his life leading up to his crucifixion. It's between the third and half of the Gospels are given over to that, relatively speaking, very short period of time. But when it comes to others in Scripture, the case is mostly very different. For the apostles, there's only the death of James that's actually recorded in the Bible. In Acts 12 verse 2, he had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. The death of Paul, the death of Peter and others, it's not recorded in the Scriptures. We know from tradition, we know from other writings how most of the disciples met their end, but not all. But there's only one that's actually recorded in the Bible of the apostles. Abraham. It's quite a long section given over to Abraham in the book of Genesis. But his death is spoken of like this. Then Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man and full of years, and he was gathered to his people. Isaac, Joseph, Moses and David. There's just, relatively speaking, a few verses given over to their death. But the account of Jacob's death is quite different. The account of Jacob's death, I suppose, really begins in many ways at the end of chapter 47, where I began reading. And it ends right at the very end of chapter 49. Although the first half of chapter 50 is really talking about his burial. I think there's 73 verses that are actually covering the death and the burial of Jacob. An awful lot when you consider one verse for Abraham and not many more for nearly everybody else. I think there's a reason for that. Jacob had had a very troubled life. I suppose we could say that Jacob was something of a pessimist in his life. There was a number of times that we're told he thought about dying, and there was a number of times when he thought about dying in a very negative way. Usually the response of things that had happened in his life, he didn't see God's providence in them, he just saw his sadness and the weight of that piling upon him, and that it would drive him, take him to his grave in utter sadness and despair. I suppose even when Jacob entered Egypt, if you think about what he said to Pharaoh, that his life had been very difficult, very hard. These 130 years, it's pessimistic, isn't it? And yet we know that he rallied, whether it was being back with Joseph and his extended family, different circumstances, and we know that he lived another 17 years. And we know that those 17 years, we may say materially, certainly spiritually, they were good years. They were years when we would describe Jacob in a way that we wouldn't have described him for the previous 130 years. They were years when he was a godly man. Had his moments before, but mostly he hadn't. But now he was a godly man. He was a man who was living for the Lord and putting the Lord first. But eventually, the words of Hebrews 9:27, just as man is destined to die once, and after that to face judgment, those words were true for Jacob. The one verse that I suppose sums everything up: when Jacob had finished giving instructions to his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. And that is exactly the same, unless Christ returns, for every one of us here. It's actually quite a sobering thought, isn't it, that those of us that were here last Sunday, or wherever you were last Sunday morning at 11:15, you are now 7 days, or 168 hours, 1 week closer to when somebody will say similar words about you. You will breathe your last. You will die. It's a very sobering thought, isn't it? But it's an inescapable fact. For Jacob, at this time of his life, one of his chief concerns was that he wasn't buried in Egypt. He was buried in a place called Machpelah. It was the tomb of his fathers back in Canaan. Now, that wasn't superstitious. That wasn't sentimentality, anything like that. But as Isaac and Abraham earlier, what Jacob was doing by having that desire was showing that he was standing firm now upon the promises of God. They meant something to him now in a way that they hadn't done for the majority of his life. He was standing firm upon them, and one of the clearest ways he could show that was to say to Joseph, "Take my bones, bury them in the land that God has promised. Bury them with my father, with my grandfather, with Isaac and Abraham." Jacob was saying, "I've at last come to realise that God's promises are true. I'm at last absolutely certain that I believe in the promises of God. And somehow, God, through this family..." Probably had a wry smile when he thought about this family. "But God, somehow through this family, is going to bless all nations." And he could sit there or lie there and he could say, "But for me there is a life to come." And he was sure that through his life he was part of that jigsaw that God was completing to gather together people from every tongue, every tribe and every nation, until every piece in that jigsaw was complete. He had, yes, that sure hope of death, of what would be beyond death, in exactly the same way that Isaac had, in exactly the same way that Abraham had, in exactly the same way many years later that we know David had. In 2 Samuel chapter 12, we read these words. He answered when the child was still alive. This was after Bathsheba's child had died. When the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. I thought, who knows, the Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. But now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? Then he said this, David, I will go to him. He won't return to me. But after my death, as life, as a believer, as a follower, I will go to him. I hope that's your hope that David had, that Abraham had, that Isaac had, that Jacob had, that you will have too. 7 days, 168 hours, closer not just to death, but to that sure hope of going into the very presence of God, of going into glory as a child of his. Jacob had learnt, hadn't he? Jacob had learnt over the years, very, very slowly, maybe more steps backwards than forwards at times, but he'd learnt that God could be trusted. The times God had said to him expressions like, I am with you. I will be with you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you. At the time, they maybe not meant much to him. But when he looked back, he could see God was telling the truth. God was right. And now those promises of God, they mean so much to me. As did that promise of life beyond the grave. Jacob, as he was dying, could testify to the faithfulness and the trustworthiness of God. Whether you've been a Christian for a year, or whether you've been a Christian for 70 years, or for some maybe even more, are you able to look back over your Christian life? And are you able to see the faithfulness of God and the trustworthiness of God? Because if you can do that, I'd suggest to you, as it was for Jacob now, that is a great blessing. That is a blessing of infinite worth. And it is a wonderful testimony to be able to share with others. Perhaps it's one of the things we should hear more of. We should share more with each other. Maybe even from here. God's faithfulness over the years to us. But if that's living your last days, secondly, living under God, the first 11 verses of chapter 48, living under God. One day, Israel said to Joseph, sometime later, Joseph was told, your father is ill. So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, along with him. I suppose in many ways what happens next is the high point in Jacob's life. He hears, doesn't he, that Joseph is coming, he's on his way. Maybe they'd seen his chariot in the distance. Jacob's there laid in bed and we're told he musters his strength and he manages to sit upright to greet his son. One thing that's worth noting in verse 3 and verse 11, this section, it begins and it ends with God. What a blessing that is, isn't it? To look at our life and to see the whole of our life. The whole of our life from the perspective of a life that's just surrounded by, embraced by God, beginning with God and one day ending with God. You know, that had been far from the pattern for Jacob, hadn't it, for the majority of his life. You know, the first time that God is mentioned in connection with Jacob, it was when he deceived his dad, Isaac, over his brother's birthright. And I suppose Jacob lived most of his life choosing not to have God close to him. But now as he looks back, he knows with absolute certainty, maybe he's pushed God away. With absolute certainty, God has never left him. God has always been close to him. And he recognises that. And he's so thankful to God for that. And I think that's the one thing, above everything else, he actually wants to pass on to his children. Today we want to pass on to our children, when we've gone, all manner of things. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with leaving children inheritance, things like that. There's not for one minute anything wrong with that. But I hope nobody here thinks that's the best thing that we can leave to our children. However small, however large the amount may be, whatever we leave them. Surely to leave them with a clear knowledge of God. And a clear testimony in our life and from our life to the faithfulness of God surpasses everything else that we may leave them, that ultimately will perish one day, or they'll have to leave to others. Surely, the best thing we can leave to our children is to see, for them to see in our lives a testimony to God's goodness and God's faithfulness, and them to hear from our lips a faithful testimony of what God has done for us, supporting our lives, I suppose, and what God promises he will do for all his children. It would appear that the last thing that his grandsons and his sons saw of Jacob was him giving God all the glory. And I think that's a wonderful example for us. I just wonder, what will our children, what will our young people's last memory be of us older ones? How will they remember us? Those who put God, church, somewhere in the top 10 things of their life, but there were plenty of other things above at times. Or those who always put God first. Those who had a very clear and strong awareness of the presence and love of God in their lives. And who clearly loved God and put him first. Who had a clear love for God's people and sought to be a blessing and an encouragement. I wonder how we'll be remembered after we've gone by the younger generation. Jacob really focused, I suppose, on three things, didn't he? Firstly, he focused on thankfulness. He was really thankful for the past blessings. The past blessings of God's faithfulness to his promises. The provision of seeing Joseph again. Of seeing his grandsons Ephraim and Manasseh that he'd never seen before. He said thank you to God. That was important to him. I hope it's important to us to say thank you to God. Secondly, he came to see that the hard times in his life, those times of trial, those times of difficulty, they were times, they were tools. They were tools in the providence of God to mould him, to change him, to make him into the person that God wanted him to be, however long it took. And they were tools, they were instruments in God bringing about the fulfilment of his plan. And now Jacob could look back and not just be thankful to God, but to know that, well, he had always been under God's care. Whatever befell him, God was always caring for him. God was always holding him and saying, even though he may have ignored God, God had never left him. How sad it is, and how sad it must be for a person to have to face trials and tragedies without God. It's just fate. Just the way it is. It's just my turn. Not to have a loving God's sovereign plan being worked out in your life, whether it's through joy or whether it's through tears, but to know the presence of God, the sustaining grace of God. And thirdly, there was thankfulness that God had finally conquered him. There was submission to God. He'd rejected God. He'd ignored God. There's almost that sense in which he'd fought against God. He'd allowed himself to go on that downward spiral on his own without God. Now by God's grace he was able to submit to God. And he rejoiced in that. I think that's one of the main reasons why God strengthened him right at the end of his life, to point the next generation in the right direction. That's so important for us, to be an example and to point the next generation in the right direction. We need men and women today to live lives and to proclaim those wonderful gospel truths, to speak about their gospel experience that points the next generation towards God, irrespective of the circumstances in their lives. Thirdly, living out God's will, verses 12 to 20. I'm just going to read you a small section from a book I read this week. One of the great characters of Greek literature is, I'm going to pronounce his name, how shall I pronounce it? Tiresias. I don't know. T-I-R-E-S-I-A-S. If anybody knows about whoever Tiresias is, feel free to shout how I should pronounce it out. Thebes, the blind prophet, whom Odysseus consults in the course of his return to Ithaca from Troy. Tiresias lacks physical sight. He's blind. But his blindness to things about him is compensated by his gift of seeing things to come. There is something like this in the final chapters of Genesis. Jacob is coming to the end of his life. He's about to die at the age of 147 years. He's been failing for some time. When his beloved Joseph comes to see him, bringing his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, Jacob can only pull himself up on the bed to bless them. Moreover, Jacob's eyes were failing. The text says now Israel's eyes were failing because of old age and he could hardly see. Failing, yes. But although his sight was almost gone, Jacob saw clearly what others with good eyes could not see. He saw the future. Like Tiresias of Thebes, and testified to it. It is chiefly on this note of prophecy that Genesis ends. The prophecy to his sons, we'll look at next week in chapter 49, but just for a moment, the two grandsons. Jacob passes on to these two grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh, the messianic promise, the messianic blessing. And again, there are three parts to it. Firstly, there's the prayer that God would bless these two men. Then there is what perhaps isn't obvious to us in the English, but in the original language, what there is there's actually a formal adoption taking place here. Jacob is formally adopting these two young men as his, so that they can head up two of the tribes of Israel. Joseph's name isn't one of the heads of the tribes, is it? There are 12 tribes plus Levi. 12 got land, and then there was the priestly tribe, Levi. And thirdly, there is that blessing of great posterity, something that Abraham had promised Isaac, had promised Abraham before, and more recently Jacob. It may well be that this is the point that Jacob transfers the birthright, the firstborn's right, from Reuben to Joseph. We don't exactly know when that occurred, but in 1 Chronicles 5 verses 1 to 2, we know that it happened sometime, and this may well have been it. It says, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was the firstborn, but when he defiled his father's marriage bed, his rights as firstborn were given to the sons of Joseph, son of Israel. So he could not be listed in the genealogical record in accordance with his birthright. And though Judah was the strongest of his brothers and a ruler came from him, the rights of the firstborn belonged to Joseph. That passing on of the rights of the firstborn, I suppose, brings us in many ways to the point that is of most interest in all of Jacob's actions. I suppose we can understand, can't we, why Joseph would be chosen instead of Reuben. After all, we know how early in Genesis Reuben had defiled his father's bed, therefore no way that he was going to be given that firstborn birthright. We could understand Joseph as being the favourite, being Rachel's eldest son, why he'd pass that on to Joseph instead. But it's different, it's very difficult for us to perhaps understand and to see why Ephraim, who was second, would be chosen over Manasseh, who was first. There's no indication given in the scriptures as to why Ephraim the younger received the firstborn's rights. There's no reason to suggest that Jacob was showing any favouritism here. Not at all. I think all he was doing was simply putting into practice what the Lord had revealed to him he ought to do. What the Lord had laid upon him was his will. And Jacob was submitting to what he clearly knew was the Lord's leading for him to do, to carry out the will of God. I'm not sure whether it's particularly relevant to this passage. Perhaps there is an encouragement here for those who aren't the eldest. So if you're not the eldest, you can be encouraged. Don't be disheartened. Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Ephraim, Moses, Gideon, David, and the Apostle John. They all had older brothers. and yet God used them mightily. Don't have to be the eldest for God to use you mightily. But what is far more relevant is that wherever we are in the family, whatever our circumstances are within the family and within our lives, whatever has been our past experience, thinking about at Jacob, God can use us if we will recognise him and if we will submit to him. And then lastly, living with God, verses 21-22, right at the end of chapter 48. God will be with you. I think Jacob's words that he pronounces these blessings, I think they were lived, they were born out of looking back over near enough 147 years and of seeing not how he'd walked with God, but how God had walked with him. About how God had been with him each step of the way, irrespective of how at times he'd reacted. God had always been there. God had always been there, whether there'd been good times, or whether, I suppose, more latterly, the last 20 odd years, there'd been bad times, the last 20 odd years in Canaan at least. Sadly, times when God had been ignored. He knows Joseph, Ephraim, Manasseh. He knows they're soon going to have their problems. He knows they're soon going to have their trials. I suppose he's saying, isn't he, listen, don't make the same mistakes that I made. No. The truth. Rejoice in the truth. Benefit from the blessings of the truth. Benefit from the blessings that God is with you. And that God is with you at all times in your life. The good and the not so good. What a blessing it is for an individual as they approach the end of their life to know that God is with them. To know that God is so close to you at the darkest moment in your life. And to know that just beyond that door of death, God is there to greet you into eternity. But to those who are much younger, to those who God's providence are not going to face death, maybe for many, many years to come, to those who are perhaps starting out on life itself, real life, never forget that whatever trials befall you, whatever circumstances, whatever situations you find yourselves in, if you are a child of God, God promises God will be with you. God is with you. For the Christian, as we live our daily lives, perhaps there's no greater blessing that any of us can know and experience. To know the felt, real presence of God in our lives. Amen. We'll close by standing to sing off the screen. Our last hymn, "How Firm a Foundation Ye Saints of the Lord Is Laid for Your Faith in His Excellent Word."